to the fifth case, Johnson v. Transco.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Flores. I represent the petitioner appellant, Catherine Johnson. In March of 1999, Ms. Johnson shot and killed a co-worker. At trial, Ms. Johnson's defense was, in essence, that she shot the co-worker because she believed the co-worker was going to kill her, and he attacked her. Ms. Johnson was convicted of first-degree murder because her trial counsel did virtually nothing to support that self-defense claim. For instance, trial counsel introduced a toxicology stipulation that showed the decedent's bloodstream contained morphine, cocaine, and alcohol. But the stipulation was ignored by the trial judge. Why? Because it was useless without an expert to explain what it meant. The data in the stipulation did not tell the trier of fact that the amount of drugs in the decedent's bloodstream was material and that it would have changed his behavior and made him more violent and aggressive on the day of the shooting. These were the facts that mattered, and these were the facts that were ignored. And these facts could have only been introduced by an expert opinion. Ms. Johnson believes that expert testimony here was available and would have been critical to her defense because it would have corroborated her version of events. And we don't have to speculate about how important corroboration would have been here. Ms. Johnson was the only witness to testify for the defense, and the trial judge indicated that corroboration was important. In this case, the state appellate court suggested that prejudice was mitigated here because counsel was able to argue during closing argument that the drugs in the decedent's system would have made him more aggressive and violent. And we believe the state court's decision is clearly unreasonable. It blurs the line between argument and evidence. Argument is not a substitute for evidence. And prejudice was not a high hurdle. And courts have also held...
Counsel, before you get too much further into the merits, there are some procedural default issues that need to be addressed first. So why don't you take those on? As I read the petition in question, the argument about the substances in the victim's bloodstream and the argument about the effect of the defendant's knowledge of the victim's prior homicide conviction, and the third argument about the two witnesses she wanted to call were the ineffective assistance claims that were presented to the state court. Those were not among the claims that she listed in her petition. There were some vague references to those fact patterns in some attachments, but they weren't articulated as claims in her habeas petition, and therefore we've got this default issue and exhaustion. Well, I think they were exhausted, but we've got a default question on those and then perhaps an exhaustion issue on one of the claims that she did raise about whether her counsel sufficiently advised her of her options to plead and so forth.
Mm-hmm. First, with regard to the petition, Ms. Johnson proceeded pro se in the district court, and she was entitled to a more liberal reading of her petition. Not only is there no evidence that the district court did not accord the petition the proper reading, but we believe there's evidence that the court did not. There's also no dispute here that Ms. Johnson's legal ground for relief, ineffective assistance of counsel, was presented in state court and in federal court. Your Honor hit the issue precisely. The issue is the facts concerning that legal ground. And without question, the petition could have been clearer. We do believe that Ms. Johnson put the facts before the district court that related to her claim, and the handwritten petition that she wrote out and attached to her petition was incorporated by reference to the form petition that she submitted in the district court. But more importantly, ineffective assistance of counsel is one ground for relief. And Ms. Johnson raised that ground, and even though she is required to submit all of the facts that support her ground for relief, number one, we believe she did that here. Number two, we believe the habeas rules are to be interpreted to promote justice. And this is not a situation where a litigant is trying to game the system. Ms. Johnson's claim has never been fully heard on the merits. So Ms. Johnson is not trying to get multiple bites at the apple. She's trying to get one. So we believe the only just result here is to allow Ms. Johnson's claim to be heard on the merits for the first time. But with respect to the prejudice, I mentioned before the expert opinion. That's not the only problem that we have here. Counsel also failed to allow my client to proffer critical testimony at trial. This case didn't just turn on whether the decedent was the aggressor. It also turned on my client's fear of the decedent. And it was undisputed at trial that the decedent was involved in a murder case and that he bragged about the murder case to my client and other coworkers.
I thought the major point of factual dispute in the murder prosecution and the self-defense defense that was proffered was whether the victim had a weapon, specifically a screwdriver, as your client had testified to. And that was the major issue. I mean, if he didn't have a weapon, then the use of deadly force against him at close range was going to be unjustified, and the defense was going to fail. So the critical issue was less her state of mind as it was whether he had a weapon.
That certainly was an issue at trial. But his propensity for violence and his involvement in the murder case, we submit, would still be relevant. And that testimony...
How does that go to whether he had a screwdriver in his hand and was advancing on
it? It does not go to whether he has a screwdriver in his hand.
So if he does, I mean, that's what the trier of fact... And this was a bench trial, right?
This was a bench trial. That's
so
right.
The judge had to decide who to believe about this, you know, whether he had the screwdriver or didn't have the screwdriver. That was what the defense... either perfect or imperfect self-defense was going to turn on that, right?
Well, we don't believe it was purely an issue of credibility, because I think that credibility and corroboration are intertwined here. And because Ms. Johnson's testimony was totally uncorroborated by her trial counsel, and he did not submit any corroborative evidence, we believe it significantly prejudiced her at trial.
Was there any?
Corroboration? Other than there was
the two witnesses that we don't know what they would testify to?
Well, there are two things that we believe would have corroborated Ms. Johnson's version of events. First is the is an expert opinion that we believe should have been introduced, expert testimony that we believe should have been introduced at trial. We believe only an expert could testify that the mix of drugs in the decedent system would have made him more aggressive. Now, we're not saying that would
put the screwdriver
make
in
the defense
hands, right?
Unassailable, but we are saying that it would have gone a long way to corroborate and give more credibility to our client's version of events, and it was left wholly uncorroborated. And we believe that was a major factor in the trial judge's verdict. But also because... But there are significant other issues, like, for example, the two witnesses. And again, we are aware that there are gaps in this record. We don't know what those two witnesses would say, but Ms. Johnson does believe that those witnesses would provide helpful testimony. And when you combine all of these things together, we believe there's no doubt that she was prejudiced, and that counsel's performance was deficient.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
I'm just curious about what the ultimate position is, that she acted in self-defense and should be completely exonerated, or that she should have been convicted of some lesser included offense.
Well, at trial, both were argued, that she acted in self-defense, but if the trial court found that her belief was unreasonable, the trial court could have found her guilty of second-degree murder.
See, the problem with either of those, it seems to me, is the period of time that passes when she leaves and obtains this gun under pretty unusual circumstances, and then comes back.
difficult to argue that if she had this fear in the first place, that she would have even done any of those things.
That is Your Honor saying that she would have come back?
That she would have. That she, if she is afraid of this guy, why does she come back when she leaves? Then she does come back, but she comes back armed and ready for bear.
Well, she did have a responsibility to return to work. I see my time is up.
Answer, Judge.
But she did have a responsibility to return to work, so that's why she returned.
But she can only use deadly force if she fears for her life. And I don't know about returning to work if you're fearing for your life. I just don't understand how one would follow the other.
If I could just clarify, there were two separate incidents here. One was inside the tire shop, and then the second one was outside of the tire shop.
And we're interested in the second one. And that
right.
Because she left after the first one.
She left after the first one and came back. And it was during that second altercation that she was that she claimed she was attacked with a screwdriver, and that's where she would have gotten the justification to shoot. Thank you.
Thank you,
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Catherine Saunders. I'm from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General on behalf of the respondent warden. Petitioners argue the merits of this case, but it's clear that the three arguments the petitioner urges in support of a Strickland claim on this appeal are procedurally barred because she failed to raise them in her petition in the district court. The respondent agrees that petitioner raised this argument and the same three supporting arguments through one complete round of state post-conviction review. But when she came to district court, she switched gears and abandoned those three supporting arguments and instead urged a Strickland claim supported by one completely different argument, that her counsel was ineffective for failing to explain various procedures in the judicial system. And, excuse me, the district court therefore correctly held that that supporting argument was procedurally defaulted because that was not one way in which she'd ever argued to the state courts that her counsel was ineffective. Stevens versus McBride at page 894 really answers the procedural default issue certified in this case. Stevens says that although Duarte and Peoples hold the ineffective assistance of counsel is a single claim for relief, regardless of how many ways a counsel is alleged to have botched the job, and although a certificate of appealability does encompass counsel's performance as a whole, nevertheless, the purposes behind procedural default, the comity and exhaustion principles, require that a party present to the state courts both the law and the facts upon which it relies. And therefore, the failure to alert the state courts to one ground constitutes a procedural default. Petition again switched gears on this appeal. She abandoned that one claim that she, or that one supporting argument, excuse me, that she raised in support of her Strickland claim in the district court, and has now reverted to the three supporting arguments that she raised through state post-conviction. But in so doing, she simply traded one procedural bar for another. Because to preserve those three arguments for appeal, she was required to raise them in her 2254 petition in the district court. Rule 2C clearly provides that a petitioner has to specify all grounds for relief and state the facts supporting each ground. So although those three supporting arguments may be encompassed by a certificate of appealability, they're procedurally barred because she failed to raise them in the district court. And the simple fact that she raised a Strickland claim in the district court in her 2254 petition does not entitle her to raise any and all arguments in support of that Strickland claim on this appeal. And having failed to raise them in her 2254 petition in the district court, we'd ask that this court not consider them for the first time on appeal. Should the court find that these three arguments are not procedurally barred, this court should still affirm the denial of habeas relief because the state appellate court's judgment was not an unreasonable application of Strickland. The state appellate correctly concluded that petitioner could not demonstrate Strickland prejudice in light of the overwhelming evidence of her guilt. Probably the strongest evidence of petitioner's guilt was her full confession given within hours of the murder, in which she stated that she had argued with the victim over the volume of the radio in the tire shop where they both worked. He removed his cap and slapped her with it. In response, she grabbed a tire iron, raised it, and threatened to kill him. At that point, the owner of the tire shop told her to leave. So in response to Judge Evans' earlier question, I don't know that she had an obligation. The record doesn't reveal that she had an obligation to return to work. In fact, when Henry Hughes, the owner of the shop, had in fact told her to leave. Petitioner left for a short while, procured a weapon. She came back. She told, confided in one of her coworkers that she had gone home for her pistol. She began arguing again with the victim. They moved the argument outdoors. Her statement says that he was unarmed. He had nothing in his hands. She admitted in her statement to shooting the victim twice. She said the first time, shooting toward the victim twice. The first time was just a warning shot to scare him, but the second time she testified, she took aim at his chest from a distance of about 15 feet. And after she shot him, as he fell to his knees, she told him, "I told you I'd kill you." Petitioner's statement was also corroborated by testimony from three of her coworkers. One was an eyewitness who saw the shooting. He testified that the victim had nothing in his hands. He saw petitioner take aim at the victim. And two other coworkers who were not outside, did not witness the shooting, but were inside the tire shop at the time and went outside after hearing the shots, testified that the victim had nothing in or near his hands as he lay on the ground. Counsel has made much about the credibility termination, saying that the evidence, things that counsel should have done would have corroborated her credibility. Corroborating evidence was necessary to the credibility. But in fact, the credibility determinations here, and the trial court did find that petitioner was not a credible witness, but the court did not do so on the basis of lack of corroboration. Here the court found petitioner's testimony was incredible based on her demeanor at trial, saying she testified relatively straightforwardly on direct examination, but on cross-examination she started to get evasive and to parry with the state's attorney who was questioning. So it wasn't a question of lack of corroboration. It was a question of her demeanor in trial. As to why she came back after leaving the tire shop, again, in response to Judge Evans' earlier question, the state trial judge found that she came back to retaliate. She told him she'd kill him. She went out and got a gun. She confided to the coworker she got a gun. She killed him and said, "I told you I'd kill you." Given this overwhelming evidence of guilt, there's no reasonable probability that absent counsel's alleged missteps, the result of this trial would have been different. And when we look at counsel's performance as a whole, as this court's precedent says we must, we can see that counsel effectively cross-examined witnesses. He attacked the state's evidence. He questioned the reliability of petitioner's statement, saying, well, she didn't have her glasses, and it wasn't a verbatim account, and the court should credit her in-court testimony because that was in her own words. He repeatedly stressed that the victim was under the influence of drugs and alcohol. He introduced evidence. He did, in fact, introduce evidence of petitioner's state of mind. And he made effective closing arguments, raising both, again, the self-defense and the second-degree murder defenses. But in the end, counsel simply could not overcome the state's overwhelming evidence.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel.